Hey, y'all, how's it going? Welcome to the show. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. It's libertarian foreign policy, mostly. I try to, you know, switch it up a little bit, talk about economics and the cops from time to time. But mostly it's about the wars. There's so many wars. I couldn't possibly cover any of them or all of them well enough. All right. Well, so for today's show, Philip Giraldi versus Michael Pregent. And also Brandon. Oops. Well, I can't talk and type very good at the same time. Whitehall. Was it Hall or Hill? I thought it was Hill. White Hill, Whitehall. I have it here. I better double check. Ah, White Hill. Brandon White Hill will also be here. And then I have a couple of invites out. I really want to get Hannah Alam from McClatchy. She's written this great series about America's Syria policy that I'd like for you to know about. And then also there's this thing in the LA Times about the war in Yemen. Let me see if I can get them on the show too. I just don't know. Oops. Let's see. It's 12 to 2 Eastern. Yeah. All right. So, yeah, man, Giraldi. Yes. I said versus. Giraldi is going to be debating Michael Pregent from Vets Against the Deal over the, new commercials that they're, that they've put out blaming Iran for the EFP bombs in Iraq in during Iraq War II. And so this is something I brought up with Phil on the show last week. He wrote an article debunking it. Then somebody on Twitter sent those articles, or actually old articles of mine, around on the subject. And then this guy says, oh, yeah. And I says, yeah. And he says, have me on your show. And I says, you want to debate Giraldi? And he says, yeah. And so here we go. Today on the show, these guys are going to debate about the EFPs. The EFPs. Boy, it's not as powerful propaganda as it was once upon a time, but, well, then again, maybe it is. Back then, it almost caused a war. Almost was, cost us belly for a war. And, right now, it's being used to try to kill the deal, the nuclear deal. So I guess we'll see. And then Whitehall is the guy I told you he wrote this thing for. I don't know who supports this group or anything. They're probably Democrats. Maybe it's a Soros thing or something. I don't know. The Foreign Policy Research Institute. You guys know that one? But anyway, it's a decent thing. It seems well done journalism here. A quick guide. I'd say a pretty thorough guide to the foreign policy views of the Democratic presidential candidates. And I'll try to make this guy talk fast because I want him to really cover all of these guys as much as he can. And he really does a good job here. What are their positions on virtually everything? And he doesn't seem to have an axe to grind either. He's just done the research. That's all. It's a pretty good research piece here. And like this guy O'Malley, I don't know anything about him except that he was a bad mayor in Baltimore. Sent the cops out to harass regular people for living their lives all day. But other than that, I don't know a thing about him. Do you? Maybe you do. I don't know. But anyway, so this guy Whitehall, he's going to help us out. Oh, and look, he has shared his contact deals details with me. So he'll be all ready to do the show later on about all the dang Democrats. All right. So, yeah, I guess Yemen. I really want to get these LA Times folk on about the Yemen thing that they wrote. I don't know if that's going to happen or not. Now the question is, where the hell did it go? Not that one. Not that one. Oh, here it is. LA Times, U.S. boosts support role in Saudi-led airstrikes on Yemen. And, yeah, it's not just Saudi. Quite a few of the GCC states are participating in this thing. There was a quote this morning on Twitter from the head of the Red Cross saying after, 4 months, Yemen looks like Syria after 5 years of war. You know, and that sounds hyperbolic, but it's the head of the Red Cross who said it, so I don't know. Try to presume a little bit of professionalism there, right? A Saudi-led military offensive against Houthi rebels in Yemen has scored major gains this month, including recapturing the strategic port of Aden and the country's largest airbase after the Pentagon more than doubled the number of American advisors to provide enhanced intelligence for airstrikes. The role of about 45 U.S. advisors, up from 20 at joint military operations centers in Saudi and Bahrain, has been vastly overshadowed by the far larger U.S.-led air war against Islamic State militants in Iraq and Syria, so as Yemen's toll of civilian casualties and refugees. The turmoil has benefited al-Qaeda's powerful local franchise. And this was a big part of that story. I mentioned it yesterday in the Washington Post as well. Oh, here it is. In parts of Yemen, the title is, "In parts of Yemen, rebels have lost control. No one else has it yet." But when you read the article, it's all about how the USA is flying as Ayman al-Zawahiri's air force in Yemen right now. And so, yes, it's Saudi planes and GCC planes, but they're all American F-16s and F-15s. And air traffic control, obviously, as the Wall Street Journal reported, 6 weeks ago or 8 weeks ago now, is all being run by the Americans. Here in the LA Times, doubling or tripling the number of American Air Force guys helping them pick targets. And so it's an American war. It's a pseudo sort of kind of proxy war. But I mean, would you argue that Libya wasn't an American war just because it was American money fueling American bombs under the wings of French planes dropping them? You know? No, of course not. And then, yes, so it is, as they say here, overshadowed by so many other wars in the news, even on this show. I hardly cover Yemen. Hardly anybody's covering Yemen. There's a full-scale blockade. Matthew Akins and his partner had to leave from Djibouti and sneak in by crossing the Red Sea. That's some good journalism in there, Akins. And what he reported was, man, they're bombing the hell out of... He was reporting out of the area just adjacent to Saudi up there in the north, and was reporting widespread civilian casualties and destruction of civilian infrastructure. Hospitals and car dealerships and businesses and homes being bombed. Says here U.S. Special Operations was deployed for a while, but they were pulled out. But they were there, actually, I guess, lasing targets themselves for a while. But, part of this, I just have to go off of assumption, because I haven't seen much good reporting about it since that Wall Street Journal piece. But does anybody believe that the Saudis are running their own air traffic control over Yemen? And this is all American AWACS planes up there, and our battleships are the ones who are coordinating all of this. Now, I guess I don't have solid proof of that other than, you know, just I don't believe that the Saudis even could. And I know that they've admitted it before, and they continue to admit that it's our tankers refueling their jet fighters in the air, their fighter bombers, I should say. So, sounds like Obama owns it to me.
Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop. which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. If this nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone, we are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. It's my show, the Scott Horton Show. Libertarian Foreign Policy, mostly. Here live on the Liberty Radio Network from noon to 2 Eastern Time, 11 to 1 Texas Time, on the weekdays. Like I say, Phil Giraldi is going to debate Michael Pregent about the EFPs in Iraq. That's coming up here in just a few minutes. But now I want to go to something published by Robert Kelly, the former chief IAEA weapons inspector or nuclear inspector in Iraq. And it's at SIPRI.org, and I'm sorry, I forgot what that was called, so let me check real quick so I can tell you about it. The Stockholm International Peace Research Institute. This was sent on to me this morning by Josef Butt, the nuclear physicist. And this is Robert Kelly on the propaganda about Parchin, the Iranian military facility that the IAEA has already inspected twice and found nothing. But there's propaganda put out there by David Albright and others about how there's a purported large explosives chamber there. And, of course, Gareth has already debunked, you know, a huge portion of this story himself, Gareth Porter, about the so-called Soviet-era nuclear weapons scientist Danilenko, who, in fact, was not a nuclear physicist whatsoever. His specialty was creating nanodiamonds, yes, with implosion systems, but no, nothing to do with nuclear technology whatsoever. And but anyway, so the IAEA in 2011, after El Baradei left, Yuki Amano, who is exposed in the WikiLeaks as, you know, outright declaring himself a tool of the Americans and useful for whatever they want to do against Iran, came out and gave credence to these allegations again. So Robert Kelly writes, there were claims advanced by the IAEA in November 2011 that Iran had built a large steel chamber at Parchin to conduct explosives tests that might be related to nuclear weapons development. Oh, I should say here, the Parchin puzzle, also by Robert Kelly at lobelog.com, like your earlobe, lobelog.com. It's called the Parchin Puzzle, and that's his first debunking of this story about these allegations. Quoting again here. The claims come from anonymous member states of the IAEA. Now, Israel is not a member of the Non-Proliferation Treaty, and therefore they have no safeguards agreement with the IAEA, but they are a member state of the IAEA, which actually existed before the NPT in the name of Atoms for Peace and that kind of thing. And so that gives Israel the title IAEA member state without having to admit that, yeah, it came from the Israelis. Anonymous member states of the IAEA. No one has supported, has produced a single credible clue to support this assertion except by exerting a book by a Russian scientist. In the book, he says he wanted to build such a chamber, but never said that this was in Iran. The Russian scientist had built several chambers for explosive forming tests, such as making nanodiamonds. Although this may seem exotic at first, explosively formed products are very common, especially in the former Soviet Union, and are often made in chambers, usually much smaller. He said he designed the chamber in 1999 to 2000, and the IAEA says the chamber was installed in 2000. This is a very tenuous claim, given that such a chamber is roughly the size of a London bus, with massively thick steel walls. It would take several years to fabricate if Iran had the capability, which is doubtful. But one, quote, cartoon of the chamber was leaked via the press, purporting to, quote, prove its existence. The drawing was said to be made from an eyewitness account. When one looks at this apparently massive object, it is clear that it has enormous dimensions, but of particular interest are four long fins running the length of the chamber. These longitudinal fins are imaginary additions, and if there were any reinforcements, they would encircle the chamber on the outside to strengthen it. To strengthen a chamber like this from a blast inside? Why are they there? The answer lies in the book published by the Russian scientist. He shows a fuzzy photograph of the biggest chamber he had ever built up to that time for producing nanodiamonds. It is much smaller than the one he wants to build, but there are some similarities. In his photo, you notice one long line along the bottom edge. It could be a fin, but when you enlarge it and look carefully, you can see that the chamber is sitting on a bed of long wooden timbers. Not knowing what they were, the cartoonist made it into a fin and added three more for good measure. It is significant to note that the sketch was not made by an eyewitness, but a graphic artist who was given the fuzzy photo to copy. And when the eyewitness was asked to say how big the chamber was, he gave the dimensions in the Soviet book down to almost the nearest centimeter. Sound like he was coached? A person close to this story is a former deputy director general of the IAEA who was interviewed by the AP. And here's what he had to say, and there he's referring to Olli Heinonen, the hawk and liar. Quote, it was very similar to a photo. Oh, and in fact, Heinonen even has debunked the Parchin allegations, right? It was very similar to a photo he recently saw that he believes to be the pressure chamber the IAEA suspects is at Parchin. He said even the colors of the computer-generated drawing matched those of a photo he had, but declined to go into the origins of the photo to protect his source. The U.S. intelligence community, this is still Robert Kelly talking here, I'm reading from SIPRI.org. The U.S. intelligence community has a scale which they use to rate intelligence they receive. When the information contains three qualifiers in one sentence, it is likely to be ranked as of low confidence. Not that the source is not credible, but that the qualifiers in the sentence make it clear that he is not sure that this is real. Conclusion. The assessment above suggests that the cartoon depiction of the chamber is flawed in several aspects as to its purported origin and use. It is the concept of a graphic artist who has been given a photo to copy and is very likely there is no eyewitness. One only has to remember the stories of the bogus Iraqi human source curveball in 2003 to see the similarity. Indeed, and if you do remember, that was Colin Powell doing his best Adlai Stevenson impression, only instead of having satellite photos, he had cartoons of what it might look like if Saddam Hussein really had a mobile biological weapons laboratory, or many of them, driving around Iraq. Yeah, right. And, of course, if you go back to Robert Kelly's previous debunking of the Parchin propaganda at loblog.com, the Parchin puzzle, he goes into more detail about why it makes absolutely no sense whatsoever, the timeline here, from when the chamber supposedly was designed. Again, no mention that it was designed in Iran or for Iran, but even then, it was designed and then built and then put into use all within the scope of 1 year, huh, this thing. No evidence of any of that, that's for sure. All right, big debate coming up with Phil Giraldi and Michael Pregan right after this. Hey, y'all, Scott here for Samurai Tech Academy at MasterSamuraiTech.com. Modern appliance repair requires true technicians who can troubleshoot their high-tech electronics. If you're young and looking to make some real money, or you've been at it a while and just need to keep your skills up to date, Samurai Tech Academy teaches it all. And they'll also show you the business, how to own and run your own. Take a free sample course to see how easily you can learn appliance repair from MasterSamuraiTech.com. Use coupon code Scott Horton for 10% off any course or set of courses at MasterSamuraiTech.com. Hey, y'all, guess what? You can now order transcripts of any interview I've done for the incredibly reasonable price of $2.50 each. Listen, finding a good transcriptionist is near impossible, but I've got one now. Just go to scotthorton.org/transcripts, enter the name and date of the interview you want written up, click the PayPal button, and I'll have it in your email in 72 hours max. You don't need a PayPal account to do this. Man, I'm really going to have to learn how to talk more good. That's scotthorton.org/transcripts. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show, here on the Liberty Radio Network. And for our first interview today, we actually have a debate between Philip Giraldi and Michael Pregent. Phil Giraldi is a former CIA and DIA officer. He is executive director of the Council for the National Interest and writes for UNS.com and the American Conservative Magazine. His latest at UNS is Did Iranian Weapons Kill Americans? Michael Pregent is from the Washington Institute for Near East Policy and also Vets Against the Deal. And they're running an ad on TV right now against the Iran nuclear deal and citing Iranian bombs in Iraq War II. Welcome both of you to the show. How are you?
Hey, good. It's Pregent's last name.
You know what? We have a real bad connection with your phone line, it sounds like there. Michael, are you on a cell phone?
I'm on a cell. I can switch to hardline.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm okay, Scott, but I can't hear him. It's all breaking up.
Okay, well, yeah.
Let me get on a hardline.
Sure. Call right back on a landline if you can, please. There you go.
Okay, we'll do.
Okay, no problem. All right. Well, hang tight, Phil. We'll be right back there. And get this thing underway. I think he was correcting me and saying, give it a soft G. Was that it? Did anybody hear that? Pregent?
I couldn't hear it.
Yeah, I think that was it. So here, I'm sure he'll call in just one more moment here. Knocking on wood. Hi, Phil. How are you this morning? Good to talk to you again. We're live on the radio. I got to think of something to say. I got a bunch of articles. Let's see. Yeah, it's the Scott Horton Show. Hey, check out the archives, everybody, at scotthorton.org. More than 3,800 interviews now going back to 2003, if you could believe that. And proving that I've been good on everything all along with no exceptions.
I was about 1,000 of them, right, Scott?
Yeah, you're right up there. Gareth Porter still is in first place, but you must be in second place for most interviews. And I wonder, when I say that, 3,800 interviews, do people say, yeah, but it's all just Porter and Giraldi over and over again? Or do they say, oh, that must be a lot of different interviewees, it sounds like. But yeah. No, the other people get interviewed too from time to time, Phil, you know. It does happen.
Oh, it's good to hear.
Yeah. But you know, you and Gareth are pretty much my go-to guys. It's true, because you're interested in debunking all the same stuff as me, and so, you know, I don't even have to do journalism. I just call you guys, and you do all the work. It's pretty easy.
Well, that's one way to look at it, yeah.
Yeah. Man, I'm not getting a call back from him here. I don't know. You know what? I think it comes down to it. We could probably fit most of the debate in 10 minutes here anyway. I'm not exactly sure how it's going to happen, but if the whole debate has to wait for the next segment, then that'll still be all right. I guess I'll go ahead and ask you about what's your next piece for the American Conservative, Phil.
Well, it's the one that was, I was supposed to run this week for UNS, which was on Turkey.
Uh-huh.
And I predicted when I drafted it, you know, a couple of days ago, that there would be some terrorist attacks on tourists as a result. And, of course, that's what happened this morning.
Mm.
There was an attack at one of the main palaces.
Mm. And, you know, I saw a thing yesterday, though, that said that they were trying to get there. They got secret talks with the Americas trying to broker a thing between. Here he is calling right in here. We'll go on with this thing. We still got time, I think.
Is this better?
All right. Yes, that's much better.
Oh, yeah.
And I think you were trying to correct my pronunciation of your last name there. Am I right?
Yeah. It's Pregent.
Pregent.
Former intelligence officer, was with DIA and was at the National Defense University. But I'm away from all that now. Running the Veterans Against the Iran Deal, and thanks for having me.
Okay, yeah, good deal. Thanks for joining us. Happy to have you. All right, so and let's start with you, Michael. You guys are running this ad featuring a staff sergeant who was wounded by a roadside bomb in the Iraq War, and he says, "Hey, it was an Iranian bomb," And then the point of the ad is the Iranians are going to get sanctions relief and therefore money and therefore spend money on bombs and terrorism. So what is the evidence that you would cite for the bomb that wounded this Sergeant Bartlett being an Iranian bomb?
Okay, here's why. It was an explosively formed penetrator, okay? Now, I understand the argument is that they're made in Iraq, therefore they're not Iranian. But here's what you need to know. The Shia militias go to Iran. They were trained on the implementation of explosively formed penetrators. They were equipped with material to build them, the money to build them. And then they were under the direction of Qasem Soleimani of the IRGC. Qasem Soleimani is the commander of Quds Force. His portfolio is Iraq. They were directed to be used exclusively against U.S. military, up-armored Humvees.
All right. And Phil Giraldi, how do you answer that?
Well, there's a lot of suppositions in that. It's they're assuming that they were under the direction of Iran to use these weapons. They're assuming that they were directed specifically against certain targets.
Well,
including,
evidence that they were.
Could I finish? Yeah.
And
you know, I was an intelligence officer, too, and I know exactly how these intelligence assessments kind of work. There are a lot of suppositions that go into the product. And I would suggest to you that unless you have real, you know, this business of blaming Iran for killing Americans, particularly right now, when there's an agreement.
How about a seized laptop? Is that evidence? How about a seized laptop indicating
that we've seen seized laptops before that were fabricated by Mossad. So
you haven't seen seized laptops for 20 years. I'm talking about seized laptops from 5 years ago when Qasem Soleimani was in Iraq directing these attacks. You haven't seen a seized laptop for 20 years.
Can you produce that laptop and subject it to independent inspection to make sure it's not a forgery? There have been too many lies about what's been going on in Iraq and too many lies about the Iranian role. And my argument is essentially that unless you can come up with really solid evidence accusing and indicting the Iranian government in terms of these policies, a lot of what you're coming out with is just speculation.
It's not speculation. I'm not a consensus intel guy. I don't believe in consensus analysis. What we look at is pure evidence. I was an intelligence officer in Baghdad for 5 years working malign Iranian influence. Okay, we seized a laptop from Case and Lace Kazali. Are you familiar with Case and Lace Kazali?
Yeah, I am.
They are the two leaders from Asab Ahlul Haq, AH. On that laptop was directed operations against the U.S. military using explosively formed penetrators using improvised rocket-assisted motors or IRAMs. Those two individuals were actually detained and held at Cropper. They were also part of the Karbala Five. Are you familiar with the Karbala Five?
No, I'm not.
Okay, the Karbala Five, it was a group of Americans who were training Iraqis. There was an attempt to kidnap the five, take them across to Iran, and exchange them for four Iranian agents captured in Erbil. Right. The plan went south, and four Americans were executed in the back of a car by Iranian agents directly linked to Qasem Soleimani. That led to the arrest of Case and Lace Kazali, both currently leading Hashid al-Shaabi Shia militias in Iraq. So there's a direct link there. Our argument is, fine with the nuke deal. Who cares about the nuclear part of the Iran nuke deal? We have a big problem with the non-nuclear concessions in this deal, where you're actually giving Qasem Soleimani, the guy responsible for directing these attacks against Americans, freedom of movement throughout the Middle East, money, and this ability to actually travel to Russia and China, two guarantors within the JCPOA that are currently facilitating Soleimani's travel. That's what we have a problem with. And you're a counterterrorism expert. You're a counterterrorism expert. You should know that if Iran funds, arms, and directs attacks, that Iran is culpable.
All right, we got to stop right there. We'll be right back with Phil's response on the other side of this break. It's Phil Giraldi and Michael Pregent. Back after this. Hey, I'll check out the audiobook of Lou Rockwell's Fascism Versus Capitalism, narrated by me, Scott Horton, at audible.com. It's a great collection of his essays and speeches on the important tradition of liberty. From medieval history to the Ron Paul Revolution, Rockwell blasts our status enemies, profiles our greatest libertarian heroes, and prescribes the path forward in the battle against Leviathan. Fascism Versus Capitalism by Lou Rockwell for audiobook. Find it at Audible, Amazon, iTunes, or just click in the right margin of my website at scotthorton.org. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. It's a debate. Phil Giraldi and Michael Pregen debating over Iran's role in the Iraq War and the EFP bombs and what it means for the current Iran deal. And we had kind of a short segment because of telephone difficulties there to start. But where we left off, it's now Phil's turn to respond to what Michael said about Iran's relationship with Asaib al-Haq and other militias in Iraq, et cetera. Go ahead, Phil.
Yeah, I mean, I don't dispute the fact that Iran has been involved with militias on many levels, and also that Iran has been involved with one might describe as the Iraqi government. This was a natural development of the previous regime, which basically sent a lot of people into exile in Iran. But anyway, that's a side issue. The issue here is essentially that this ad is appearing at a time when clearly it's intended to disrupt an agreement that's been reached between the White House and the Iranian government and five other governments plus the UN's, the entire United Nations. Now, there's a purpose in this, and basically, the argument is intended to demonstrate in an emotional way that the Iranians were, quote, directly killing American soldiers in Iraq, which I would, and also it's intended
Phil, Phil, your phone cut out. You said, which I would
dispute the demonization of Iran as a country that's manifestly worse than other countries in the region. I don't think it is. I don't think Iran is a country that necessarily is more evil, more prone to activities that are disruptive in the region than anyone else.
All right. Well, and let me ask you, Michael, I mean, isn't it a pretty big concession to start out with that, okay, the bombs were made in Iraq? Because the accusation all through 2007 is that they were all coming from Iran, and not only that, but that proved that the Iranian government was behind it all when, as Phil says, you guys were actually over there fighting for Iran, for the Badr Brigade, for the Supreme Islamic Council, for the Dawa Party, for the Iraqi exiles who'd been living in Iran for 30 years.
Let me tell you about that. First off, they did originate in Iran, and yes, I was one of the intelligence officers saying, hey, we are witnessing the Shiification of the Iraqi security forces by Badr Corps, by Jaish al-Mahdi, and by Maliki's Dawa Party. I saw the Iraqi security forces go from a healthy sectarian balance of 50% Sunni and 50% Shia to 90% Shia with heavy militia infiltration from Jaish al-Mahdi and Badr Corps. And we also saw the dismantling of the Sons of Iraq, which was a bad thing too. But during this time, Iran was putting pressure on Shia politicians, you know, bribing them, paying them off. It was an assassination campaign against Christian, Sunni, and even Shia pilots. The Badr Corps came into Iran, to Iraq, to ensure that Iraq would never, ever be a threat to Tehran again. We concede that. We know where the mistakes were made.
Well, that was the side that you guys were fighting on, not against.
No, we were fighting against that internally as well. We were fighting against sectarianism and Shia militia infiltration of the Iraqi security forces. We were blind to that. The important thing is in 2009, we were told to take our hands off of that. When President Obama came in office, he said, okay, this is a sovereign government. Maliki's the guy. We need to let Maliki run this government. We protested and said, listen, this is now a military that will answer to Iran, heavy Shia militia infiltration. And now if you look at the Iraqi security forces, it's 95% Shia with heavy militia infiltration. And that's not even counting the Hashd al-Shaabi, which is directly run by Soleimani and Hadi al-Amri and Mohandas from Kitab Hezbollah. We see the mistakes. So we don't see a force being built to take back Mosul. Mm-hmm. We don't see a force being take back Ramadi.
But Michael, here's the thing, though. But Michael, what's happening is Americans know that we lost almost 5,000 over there fighting, but we lost almost all of them fighting the Sunni-based insurgency, a great many of those to roadside bombs, none of which came from Iran, and even you concede that many, at least, of the EFPs were made... Even you concede that many of the Shiites' EFPs were made in Iraq.
That's too absolute.
But what's happening is you're trying to pin.
Are you going
to
let me answer it?
Well, but you were talking all through my statement, so I'm not sure whether you heard me or not. You're trying to pin 4,500 deaths on Iran when it was Iran's enemies who did most of those, when America was fighting on Iran's side.
We're talking about 500 deaths in Iraq directly
out of 5,000, right? And those, as you conceded, many of those bombs even were made in Iraq.
We don't say 5,000, my man. We say 500 and thousands made by Iranian explosively formed penetrators. The Iranians developed a mission that was able to counter our up-armored capability that we reintroduced after being blown to hell by Al-Qaeda IEDs. They developed a weapon that could actually penetrate. That was called the explosively formed penetrator. They started doing that when the MRAP was introduced into Iraq. Okay, this is the capability the Iranians brought in. You know,
but that's nonsense. The IED was a weapon that was used by the IRA in the 1930s. You know,
but we're talking about Iraq, my man. We're talking about Iraq and Iran, not the IRA. Okay, we're talking about explosively formed penetrators introduced into Iraq by Iran. We're not talking about the IRA. If you have to go that far back to make an argument, you know, come on.
How about some evidence that the Iranians actually introduced these weapons? If you go to the link in my article, which it links to a Garrett Porter article, it demonstrates all the seizures of bomb-making factories inside Iraq that were producing these weapons, which kind of contradicts this idea that they were being introduced.
You're conflating IEDs with EFPs, and you should know that.
I'm using IED as a generic. You know it's a generic.
Yeah, no.
IED is what the Sunni insurgency used. The explosively formed penetrator is what we're talking about.
Yeah, and those were the factories that were found in Iraq, in Baghdad, and in Basra.
Where?
The Christian Science Monitor and the Wall Street Journal and Patrick Coburn in The Independent.
Exactly.
It was reported over and over and over again that these were found in Iraq, in the Shiite parts of Iraq, being made by Shiites in their bomb-making factories.
By Badr Corps, by Jaish al-Mehdi, by Assad al-Haq, by Kitab Hezbollah, all Iranian proxies, all falling under the command of Qasem Soleimani, who was delisted under this Iran deal. That's our issue.
Well, at that time, the Badr Corps was the Iraqi army under the command of the USA.
That is just a weak, weak argument. A weak argument. Badr Corps followed us in when we invaded in 2003. Yes. They are an Iranian-backed proxy militia force. Yes. They sold us. Yeah, they did sell us that they were the horse to pick. And Badr Corps represented the officer corps of the Iraqi security forces. The intelligence community, working with General Petraeus and Odierno, rooted these guys out when we discovered who they were. We were told hands off by the Obama administration to let Maliki fill the ranks with whoever he wanted to fill the ranks with.
So the American war led directly to the rises.
This does not demonstrate. Does not demonstrate in any way that Iran at any considerable level was introducing weapons into Iraq and targeting them to kill Americans. And all you've cited so far is this laptop, which nobody has seen, and which, given the history of laptops in Iraq, could well be another fake.
All I've cited were IRAMs, an assassination campaign, Shia militia proxies, a captured laptop directly related to the Karbala 5, which you've never heard of, Case and Leif Kazali, who you didn't know who they were either. I'm introducing things that provide currency to this debate. I'm trying to bring you up to speed.
Why are you doing this now, and who exactly is funding your organization?
Great Americans. Great Americans.
Great Americans.
Hillary Clinton is funding this because she doesn't want to run for president with this hanging around her neck. How about that? Does that sound
why don't you put some information on who's paying for you on your website? I mean, your website is completely devoid of information.
Are we going to talk about Iran and Iraq? Or are you going to go back to this default base argument of who's funding you? Who's funding
you? Yeah, well, I think great Americans,
families of veterans, patriots are funding us. Okay, look at our advisory board. Yeah, that's your argument. Argue about Iraq and Iran, not about who's funding us.
No, I'm looking for evidence on Iran having produced these weapons, given these weapons, and directed the use of these weapons, and you haven't produced anything.
You send me an email, and I'll give it to Scott here, and I'll send you all the information you're not going to want, okay? I'll send you all the information you're not going to want. You do a freedom of information request on that. I'm not providing you that. You can actually search the Karbala 5 and the laptop and AH and Case Kazali, and you'll find stuff out there. You'll be able to find stuff out there. Mm-hmm. It'll be something that happened within the last 20 years.
Well, Michael, it's also pretty easy to find Michael Knights at Jane's Defense Review and articles in the Wall Street Journal and all over the place.
Michael Knights, you interrupt so much.
Why don't you be quiet for a second and listen? Where General Pace, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, says, yeah, actually, we don't really have evidence of this. There's times when Petraeus was going to lay out and do a big press conference in Iraq and show all the Iranian weapons, and all the skeptical reporters started gathering around, and they canceled it because they actually didn't really have any evidence at all.
You asked me why I'm not quiet. It's because of these types of comments. This is ridiculous.
What, quoting the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, wherein he says he can't really back it up?
Selectively quoting, yes. I worked for General Petraeus in Iraq. Okay, we know the evidence. This veterans organization is former CIA guys, okay, former NSA guys, former DIA guys, and veterans for the last 36 years going back to Beirut. What's since you're a 20-year guy out of the window kind of guy there, tell me about the Beirut bombing. Did Iran have anything to do with that?
No.
Iran had nothing to do with directing Hezbollah to attack the Marine barracks in Beirut in 1983, killing 241 Marines. Iran had nothing to do with that?
There is no evidence that Iran directed Hezbollah to do that. There was a civil war going on in Lebanon, you might recall, and our troops and our embassy and our CIA station were in there basically against Hezbollah, and Hezbollah attacked them. There is no evidence that Iran directed anyone.
Has Iran ever done anything bad, in your opinion?
Yeah, they've done a lot of bad things. And if you look up when I've been writing about Iran, I'm very critical of Iran. I have no illusions about Iran. An Iranian tried to kill me in Istanbul. So I have no illusions whatsoever about Iran. But the fact is that to denigrate the country and to be laying out all these lies at a time like this...
We're not denigrating the country. We're denigrating the IRGC and the Quds Force. IRGC and the Coup Force. That's who we're denigrating.
Hey, I don't have a problem with that.
Okay, good. We agree then.
Yes.
All right, well, that's a good place to stop because we're over time anyway, guys. But thank you both, Phil Giraldi and Michael Pregent.
Thank you very much.
Hey, y'all. Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future of Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Jacob Hornberger, tireless champion of liberty and president of the FFF, brings you the best libertarian writers every month on the topics that need our treatment the most. Read Jacob, Jim Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, Joe Stromberg, and more every month in The Future of Freedom. It's just $25 a year for the pocket-sized print edition, $15 to read it online. The Future of Freedom, fff.org/subscribe. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers. Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. Got a good chat room question I'm going to answer for you in about half an hour from now, if you'll hang around. But right now, we go to Brandon George Whitehill from the Foreign Policy Research Institute. He wrote this, I think improperly titled article, A Quick Guide to the Foreign Policy Views of the Democratic Presidential Candidates. I'd say it's pretty thorough. Very good job. Welcome to the show. How are you doing, Brandon?
I'm doing well. Thank you for having me, Scott.
Very happy to have you here. And, well, very, very happy to read this. This is great. Bit of research that you've got here. We've got two 10-minute segments, and if it's okay with you, I'd just like to go through just about as much of this as we can get through. Tell me first all about Jim Webb.
So I kind of have a methodical order in how I did this. If I can just give a general overview first.
Sure,
On the last day of my internship with the Foreign Policy Research Institute, I had a really interesting conversation with someone there who said that the Democratic Party can be kind of characterized by a triangle with three points. On one point, you have the Clinton family, ever since Bill Clinton, and then Al Gore was kind of a product of the Clinton family, then Hillary in 2008, then as Secretary of State, now as a presidential candidate. And then another point is the more left progressive side, which loves Elizabeth Warren. Their candidate is Bernie Sanders. When we get to Lincoln Chafee, at least on foreign policy, he's certainly far on the left there. And then the third point is the more moderate, try to appeal to the independents and that kind of group of people. And that is Jim Webb and, differently, but in a kind of the same way, Martin O'Malley. So to start with Jim Webb, he takes a very, drawing on his own personal experiences, he takes a very moderate approach to foreign policy that is neither characterized by the far left or the far hawkish right. He is the only veteran running for the Democratic nomination. He was a Marine captain in the Vietnam War. Also served under the Reagan administration as Assistant Secretary of Defense and Secretary of the Navy. And his whole approach at foreign policy is, you know, caution and consistency. He says the biggest foreign policy issue that we have today is that we do not have a consistent doctrine ever since the fall of the Soviet Union. We've intervened inconsistently. We've intervened when we should not have. And he's highlighted along the years all the mistakes we've made. He wrote an op-ed 3 months before the vote to authorize force in Iraq, opposing it, calling it a strategic blunder, saying unilateral wars designed to bring about regime change and long-term occupation should be undertaken only when a nation's existence is at stake. And so he'd like to see a more consistent approach of foreign policy. And his favorite doctrine throughout history is the Nixon Doctrine, which said, you know, we'll be a nuclear umbrella for our allies, but we're not going to undertake the defense of all the world's free nations. So I don't know if you want to get into specific policy views of each one, but that's his general approach at foreign policy.
Well, I might add, and I'm not sure if this has too much to do with your article, really, but I mean, he is running for president, and it seemed like what he had going for him was all of those kind of conservative or right-wing and military credentials, being the Secretary of the Navy under Reagan and all those things. But then while he was a senator, he... I don't know how anti-war he was, but he certainly supported the Baker Plan for getting out by 08 rather than the surge and all that kind of thing. And it seems like that would have been what's unique about Webb is if he's running to the right in Hillary pretty much in every way at set piece and running with her as the hawk and him as the more responsible and less wild in foreign policy kind of thing. That kind of seeming contradictory thing is what could have made him special. And then he came out against the Iran deal, and so now he's just as bad as anybody. What does he have going for him at all? So now he's just more like a Republican than a Democrat, I guess.
Well, yeah, he's certainly the only Democratic candidate who's come out against the Iran deal, so that is what really sets him apart. And that is certainly something that's to the more, I guess you could call it the hawkish right of the general pool of candidates. But you look at, I guess there's two ways of looking at it. You can look at what they're saying now, and you can look at the entire experiences that they've had. And if you look at what they're saying now, just kind of a cross section, you might not see Webb as the more anti-war and the more reasonable candidate for foreign policy. But if you look at everything that's gone back, you know, his opposition to the Iraq War, his time in the Senate, he went to Burma to open relations there, which set a precedent for the administration to open up relations with Burma. He's a very reasonable person. He supports normalizing relations with Cuba. Whereas if you look at what Clinton is saying now, you might see her, oh, she doesn't want to put troops on the ground for ISIL. She's for the Iran deal, you know, no war there. But if you look at her record, she supported the Iraq War. She supported the Patriot Act. She supported She defended her Iraq war vote in the 2008 election. She vigorously advocated the intervention in Libya.
And on, right, yeah.
I mean, there's a long
record.
Yeah,
we'll get back to her whole list, but your point, though, I understand what you're trying to say, though. With this latest wrinkle, I think he really blew it. It's not too late for him to change on that and be good on the Iran deal, too. I think then he would have a great set of talking points for running against her. Running to her right on the Iran deal seems like a bad strategy. I wonder if that guy Shrum, did someone hire Bob Shrum to tell Jim Webb what to do? That guy always tells every Democrat to run as a Republican, and they always lose.
And certainly he hasn't taken the same rhetoric as some of the Republican candidates are saying, tear it up on day one. He's said he's against it, certainly, but he has said, you know, he has some reservations about it, would like to get a better deal.
But that's enough to make every Daily Coast kid say, well, never mind you then. You know what I mean? That whole, like you said, that policy typically belongs on more the progressive left side. So he would have been unique to use it, but instead he blew it. That's all I'm saying. Anyway, let's move to, cause we'll have to do Clinton in the next segment because she's going to take so long, but let's move here to Bernie Sanders. He seems like a nice guy. Everybody seems to like him so much and all this stuff, but, how anti-war is he really? I notice he doesn't seem to talk about it on the campaign trail at all.
So yeah, every time you hear Bernie Sanders talking about foreign policy, whether it's about war, whether it's about diplomacy or whatever it may be, he brings in economics and the state of our domestic economy. And he says, this is a cool quote that kind of encompasses that, the United States has a lot to be concerned about, and we should be concerned absolutely about the Assad regime, we should be concerned about ISIS, we should be concerned about the terrible poverty that exists in Africa and parts of Asia, but we should also be concerned about that in America. Our middle class is disappearing and that we have more people living in poverty than at any time in history in this country. And that kind of encompasses how if you talk about ISIL, yeah, they're a threat. We should do this. But we have Americans suffering here, and I'll be damned if we send more taxpayer money and more American young people to go fight that when we have so many problems here.
Well, and that really is unique for him to just talk about the Islamic State in realistic terms rather than the politically mandated terms of the most hysteria, which is what everybody else is going with.
Right. And he does have a pretty long-standing, consistent record of being anti-war. In 1991, he voted, he opposed, he was in Congress at the time, the House of Representatives, he opposed Bush 41's invasion of Kuwait to get Saddam Hussein out of there, which was something that was kind of hailed as multilateralism. Look at the United States in partnership with all these countries, but he opposed that. He did vote for the authorization of force after 9/11, but voted against Iraq, voted against the surges, voted against the Patriot Act, all of these big programs to fight the war on terror. And he was against the Libya intervention and pretty much against everything that Hillary Clinton was for. So it is a pretty consistent anti-war record on that front.
Yeah. Well, and I know he was pretty damn rude when it came to his position on what happened in Gaza a year ago. But I guess overall, he's more or less better on Palestine than somebody like Hillary. I mean, he does say he wants a two-state solution and sooner, not later, that kind of thing. That's worth, I'm not sure. I don't know.
Yeah. The viral video you're referring to is a pretty heated exchange. And we have to take it in the context that he is the only Jewish candidate running for president, so that certainly has something to do with his experiences. Yeah.
Well, you know, there he has that same Jim Webb thing where he has his Zionist flank covered. He can go ahead and be a peacenik on the issue, right?
Yeah.
Just like Webb has his "I was the Secretary of the Navy" flank covered, so he can be a peacenik. If they choose they could be even easier than Hillary, who has to prove that she's a real man, which is a different set of circumstances. You know what I mean? She has to do that whole 3 a.m. in the morning, I can be just as tough as any male president thing, which is a different sales pitch that she at least believes that she has to push. Anyway, sorry we have to take this break now. Sorry for talking so much. When we get back, we're going to learn more about Martin O'Malley and Hillary Clinton and the positions of the Democratic presidential candidates on bombing foreigners. It's Brandon George Whitehill from FPRI.org. We'll be right back after this. Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at Darren'sCoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world, all specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. Darren'sCoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. Darren'sCoffee.com.
This part of the Scott Horton Show is sponsored by Audible.com. And right now, if you go to audibletrial.com/Scott Horton Show, you can get your first audiobook for free. Of course, I'm recommending Michael Swanson's book, The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite. Maybe you've already bought The War State in paperback, but you just can't find the time to read it. Well, now you can listen while you're out marching around. Get the free audiobook of The War State by Michael Swanson, produced by Listen and Think Audio, at audibletrial.com/Scott Horton Show.
I'm still breaking hearts announcing the winner of that Costa Rica trip. Yeah, sorry, Megan, you missed it, dude. John Cornish won. All right. Yeah, so hey, I'm Scott Horton. I'm talking with Brandon George Whitehill. He wrote this great quick guide, he calls it. Pretty thorough. Worth your time. It's, I guess maybe we ran at antiwar.com yesterday. But anyway, you could find it there in the viewpoint section. A quick guide to the foreign policy views of the Democratic presidential candidates. And so we pretty much, I think, gotten Webb and Sanders out of the way. We touched on Clinton a little bit, and everybody knows how bad she is. Jean Healey talked yesterday on the show about how her making up with Bill after Lewinsky was over urging him to bomb Serbia. That's who she is. So we, and you mentioned a bunch of other horrible things about her. But so just for time's sake, let's save her to the end. And if there's much more to say about Sanders, go ahead. And then otherwise, I don't know anything about O'Malley. Oh, and then yeah. I got to make sure and hit the button so that people can hear you talking. Go ahead.
Okay, we good? So, yeah, Sanders, I think we wrapped up pretty nicely. He's concerned with progressive reforms on the domestic front, something that some people kind of say the same thing as Obama with healthcare. That was his crown jewel. They're interested in the progressive agenda there. So that's really what he focuses on, even tying those things to foreign policy. So even if we spend a couple seconds on it, it's worth mentioning Lincoln Chafee here also, who
I forgot for a second. Yeah, Thank you for remembering.
You would because, you know, no one really knows who he is. But he was in the Senate during 9/11 and the votes on Afghanistan and Iraq, and he was the sole Republican vote against the war in Iraq. So he has that record behind him. Though it's sort of a pejorative term today, I think Chafee could be considered what some would say is a pacifist. He's the only candidate who's advocated talking to ISIL, not sanctioning Russia or China. He's very open to warming relations with other countries, and his whole motto is wage peace. So he's unique sort of in that sense.
Yeah. And he's an interesting guy. Former, I guess the son of a Rockefeller Republican was how he got his Senate seat, right?
Yeah.
Because he sort of inherited it. And he was kind of the last rhino liberal Republican, Northeastern establishment Republican. And then, as you said, he was the only one in the Senate and from that spot, opposed Iraq War II. But then, or I guess even before then, he switched to the Democrats, right? Or no, that was the other guy I'm thinking
of.
Who,
Chafee was a Republican senator. Then he was an independent governor of Rhode Island.
Right.
And I believe in 2013, he officially registered as a Democrat.
I was thinking of, I can't remember the guy's name anymore. There was a Senate Republican who switched to the Democrats in 2001, I think, and changed the balance. But I got him confused for a second. I wish I could remember his name. At least I'd get that straight. Anyway, okay, so go ahead and tell us all about O'Malley. All I know is I heard he had a bad police policy in Baltimore.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm not a Maryland citizen, but my friends who I have made from Maryland are not big O'Malley fans. Anyway, on the foreign policy front, he's saying a lot of the same things Clinton is saying. Where they diverge from Sanders, Chafee, and to an extent Webb, is that they say we need to be more engaged with the world. And certainly not in an armed sense, sending troops to go fight ISIL on the ground, for example. They don't want that. But O'Malley would say that it's irresponsible to say that we need to retrench, that we need to bring things back home. He says that the strongest thing America can do abroad is have a strong middle class, because that will project certain values about capitalism and freedom and everything. But he certainly says that retrenchment as a policy is understandable but irresponsible. And he's a big advocate for multilateralism, talking with other nations, strategic collaboration, you know, those big words that foreign policy scholars use. That's his big thing. And he brings a lot of progressive causes to foreign policy too, talking about a strong domestic economy, addressing climate change, income inequality are big things that he says we need to do. He wants to have clean energy by the year 2050. And he directly linked, and got some criticism for it, directly linked climate change to the rise of ISIL, saying, you know, because we wiped out farmers, well, not we, but the drought in Syria wiped out farmers, that led to instability and the rise of ISIL. So he really ties those things and makes them kind of inextricable in that sense.
Hmm. Well, in fact, you know, I had read about how the drought and the famine had helped, you know, push all the country Sunnis to the outskirts of the cities, and all the, you know, crises that came about from that, without necessarily being connected to climate change theory or activism in general at all, but just, hey, there are famines in the world, and that is what happened here. You know, whether you want to call it climate change or somebody else doesn't is sort of beside the point at that point, right?
But right.
Yeah. It does seem to be he's on to something there, at least in the part of the causal chain. I mean, the whole Arab Spring was one big bread riot, really.
Right. So. And he's for humanitarian assistance abroad to provide, you know, sort of the standard of living that's needed to have a strong middle class. This is, like I said, one of those values that he wants to project on his record. You know, as a governor, he's probably the least experienced in foreign policy of all these candidates. I mean, all of these candidates were in Congress at some time, dealt with foreign policy firsthand, except O'Malley. But he was against the Iraq War from the beginning. He was against the intervention in Libya. He's for this Iran deal now. So he has kind of established himself with that.
Good that he was against Libya when Hillary was pushing for it. I hope that gives them something to fight about in the debate. Mm-hmm. Somebody wants to fight about that in the debate.
Oh, I'm sure they will. Yeah.
Yeah. And then, so now we won't have enough time to finish, but run down this list of things that Hillary bombed.
Well, Hillary was part of, if we go back to the Clinton administration, she pushed for a lot of these campaigns to bomb where ethnic cleansing was happening. She was a big advocate for that. But then in her own career in the Senate, she voted for the Iraq War, for the Patriot Act in 2008 in the primary. She defended her vote while Obama, as a state senator at the time, was against it from the beginning. While in the Senate was against it, she said, you know, it maybe wasn't the right idea, but I think it was the right thing she didn't regret her vote at the time. She didn't really regret her vote until her memoir, when she said it was a mistake, plain and simple. So she has that on her record, of course. And then as Secretary of State, pushed for the intervention of Libya, which was a complete and utter disaster. You have the Republicans at her heels about Benghazi, this whole email scandal now, and whether or not she compromised national security. And she also writes in her memoir that she was for arming Syrian rebels, and that was a mistake to not be more proactive on that front. So, yeah. I mean,
well, and the Afghan surge too was, you know, that was her and Petraeus. She definitely helped to push the consensus world. And, you know, going back actually 2009, and I hate to give Obama credit for anything. He doesn't deserve credit, but I mean, in fact, they successfully buffaloed him, but she kind of ganged up on the president with Petraeus and McChrystal and the rest of them, even as they were leaking to the media saying he's dithering and taking too long and all this kind of stuff. She was really bad on that, and I think to a great deal responsible for giving the president no choice, quote unquote, but to go along with the plan to surge there.
Yeah, and I mean, you look at the major foreign policy decisions that have been made, and she's really been on the hawkish side of all of them, whether or not she's come to regret them.
Yeah. Well, and of course, there's her, pivot to Asia too. I knew we were going to run out of time. The whole pivot to Asia and her giant, you know, essay that she wrote for Foreign Policy about America's new Asian century coming and containing China there and all that. So anyway, hey, great work here, man. Thank you very much for coming on the show, Brandon. I appreciate
it. Thanks for having me.
All right, y'all. That is Brandon Whitehill at FPRI.org, a guide to the foreign policy views of the Democratic presidential candidates. We'll be right back. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here for Liberty.me, the social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place and features classes, discussions, guides, events, publishing, podcasts, and so much more. And Jeffrey Tucker and I are starting a new monthly show at Liberty.me, Eye on the Empire. It's just $4 a month if you use promo code Scott when you sign up. And hey, once you do, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me.
Hey, Al Scott here. First, I want to take a second to thank all the show's listeners, sponsors, and supporters for helping make this show what it is. I literally couldn't do it without you. And now I want to tell you about the newest way to help support the show. Whenever you shop at Amazon.com, stop by ScottHorton.org first. And just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page. That way the show will get a kickback from Amazon's end of the sale. It won't cost you an extra cent. And it's not just books. Amazon.com sells just about everything in the world, except cars, I think. So whatever you need, they've got it. Just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page at ScottHorton.org or go to ScottHorton.org/Amazon.
All right. So, yeah, man, again, you can find that guy's article at if you go to antiwar.com/viewpoints. That's, you know, the last few dozen we've run for you there. Or actually, it's just pages and pages of them. And so we ran as a viewpoint yesterday, I think. And it's good. It's just, you know, as much research as the guy could do on what all the damn Democrats said about what.
And they're all horrible. You could tell there, but.
I guess Sanders de facto the best of them, but that ain't saying much. And of course, he's horrible on unemploying everyone in America. So, you know, I mean, I guess that's one way to end the empire. It's just completely bankrupt us all. I hereby will pay everyone to quit their job and go to school. Okay, I'll do it. There's all kinds of classes I'd like to take, now that you mention it, Mr. President. And I don't have to pay you back? Alright. I'm gonna learn pottery, dude. Alright. Hey, man, so, guy in the chat room says, hey, Scott Horton claimed in that Tom Woods interview that Iran ain't making nukes. God almighty, I'm so sick of this. And yet, Obama says, oh my God, Iran nukes. This deal is the only way to stop them. And so how come Scott Horton is so far to the left of even Obama on this? And you can see how that works. That's a perfectly good argument, man. I totally understand where you're coming from. The thing of it is, Obama lies about everything. He happens to be doing the right thing here in trying to get this deal done. I'm glad for that. But yes, he has chosen as his talking point that Iran is just as evil as everyone ever said, that they're just as hell-bent on a nuclear weapon as anybody ever said, that everything the war party ever said about them is right, and that's why we gotta support the deal, instead of that's why not to support the deal. And so, okay, whatever. This is what happens when it's Republicans and Democrats. As James Bovard said about the Waco hearings, watching these guys, he said, it's like drunks fighting in a bar. They swing and they miss. And so that's the answer. Now, to the truth, here's the truth. The most weaponly anything you could possibly conceive Iran's nuclear program as being is a half a deterrent, right? To sit on the capability to make nukes without making nukes in order to encourage others, like, say, the Americans, to calculate that, well, we could bomb their nuclear program, but they already know how to, you know, they've mastered the fuel cycle. We can't bomb their knowledge away. And so if we do bomb their civilian nuclear program, then that'll only induce them to make a bomb. And the only way to stop that would be to invade and occupy the whole damn place. So maybe we should just settle for letting them have their civilian nuclear program. They're half a nuclear deterrent, right? That's like the worst way that you could characterize their civilian nuclear program, is it's a subtle hint that, see, it's civilian. And we'd all like to keep it that way, wouldn't we? Right? And a nice way to discourage regime change. It's a defensive move. That's it. Now, as far as the actual reality of the program, they've never enriched to weapons grade anything. Not one atom. Not never. They never had a nuclear weapons program at all. It's alleged that they had done some research and experiments along those lines in the very early 2000s, but that all that halted in 2003 when America got rid of Saddam Hussein for them. And that's what the DIA and the CIA believe. That was when he finally went ahead, when the Iranians went ahead and made sure and call off any and all research along those lines. And whenever they've been so-called caught doing something illegal with their nuclear program, it actually isn't true. They've only ever been caught digging giant holes in the ground that ended up becoming nuclear facilities. But according to the safeguards agreement under the Non-Proliferation Treaty, that's not a crime. The promise is that they will notify the IAEA 6 months before the introduction of any nuclear material into any centrifuges or anything else. So, or, you know, any into any machinery of any kind. That's the deal. And they've never broken that. They've had a safeguarded nuclear program all along. They have a reactor at Iraq and Bushehr. They have a civilian enrichment plant at Natanz and Fordo. They have a conversion facility where they convert the refined yellow cake uranium to uranium hexafluoride gas, which they introduce in the centrifuges. All of this stuff is safeguarded by the IAEA. All this stuff has been safeguarded by the IAEA all along. The IAEA has continued to verify the non-diversion of nuclear material in Iran to any military or other special purpose umpteen million times, 4 or 5 or 6 times a year or whatever it is. They come out with a report. They say the same thing over and over and over again. And then there's a lot of smoke, mostly hot air, you know, actually steam, not smoke. Comes in mostly by the way of Israeli accusations. What about this? What about this? What about this? But they always just explain it all away. Aha! We found an isotope, a tiny bit of leftover, highly enriched uranium, not weapons grade, but still highly enriched uranium. How do you account for that? And they said it must have come from the Pakistani tests on the equipment before they sold it to us. So the IAEA went to Pakistan and then they said, well, hey, look, it matches perfect. The isotope is exactly the same. Problem solved. Oh, what about the magnets? Oh, look, everybody. The magnets of death. Yep, here they are, right here, sitting on the countertop at the university being used for completely non-nuclear purposes, you know, by grad students and whatever. And there's just an endless torrent of accusations, many of them funneled through the Mujahideen e-Kulk communist terrorist cult, which has absolutely zero support whatsoever inside Iran to be the new communist cult dictatorship there after this one's gone. They hope. And it's all nonsense. And most of it is made up by the Israelis. And so, but that's okay because what's happened is the Americans have insisted that and the EU and the Russians and Chinese have gone along mostly to placate the Americans and the Israelis, who have perennially threatened to launch an aggressive war in order to take out the facilities. And this is the argument that Rand Paul said that he believed in, that and Obama made the case to the international community. You arm me up to the eyeballs with sanctions. I'm going to clamp down like hell on their nuclear program, and then I'm going to bring them to the table, and I'm going to force them to accept the additional protocol. We are going to no longer insist that they have to stop enriching uranium, which is an impossible request, complete capitulation, which they will never abide by, but we will get them under an expanded protocol, expanded inspections, and scale back their nuclear program to a great degree and make this deal. That was the reason for the sanctions in the first place, and so now they've got the deal. And under the deal, they're going from 20,000 something centrifuges down to 5,000. They're completely closing the Fordo facility, or actually they're turning into a research facility that has no nuclear material there whatsoever. And they are converting the Iraq reactor to a light water reactor that will produce its waste will be, if it produces plutonium at all. I guess I'm not exactly certain how they're going to arrange it, but Americans will be redesigning the damn reactor with them, and it will not be producing weapons grade plutonium as waste in any way, even if they had the conversion facility that they don't have in order to, you know, purify the stuff that they don't even have. So anyway, there you go. They're going from a civilian safeguarded nuclear program to a civilian safeguarded nuclear program with an additional protocol to their safeguards agreement and with a much further scale back. Oh, and they're scaling back their quantity of uranium. They're still only enriching to 3.6% electricity grade, nowhere near weapons grade, but they're keeping the quantity at almost nothing. They're going ahead and converting all of it to fuel rods and using it up, and they're committing to never having a stockpile that even theoretically could be used to be enriched up to 90-something percent. So It's a good deal in every way. Now, I prefer the Ron Paul solution, which is, hey, Ron, all sanctions are canceled. You're free to go. I'd appreciate it if you stay within the NPT, huh? Okay, thank you. That's a real solution, but I'll settle.
Don't you get sick of the Israel lobby trying to get us into more wars in the Middle East? Or always abusing Palestinians with your tax dollars? It once seemed like the lobby would always have full-spectrum dominance on the foreign policy discussion in D.C. But those days are over. The Council for the National Interest is the America lobby, standing up and pushing back against the Israel lobby's undue influence on Capitol Hill. Go show some support at councilforthenationalinterest.org. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org.
All right, I'm back. Oh, yeah, so JDA was joking around in the chat room. I'm secretly some kind of liberal or Democrat or something for supporting the Iran deal, but the thing of it is that, well, a war with Iran would just suck so bad, man. And I think there are at least some factions in Israel who would like very much to get America into war with them. And I think that this deal can very much preclude that possibility. Remember, Netanyahu told his cabinet, and they came right out and told all the papers, not just Haaretz, but Times of Israel and the rest ran it. All the right-wing papers ran it. That he told his cabinet that he's afraid that Iran won't cheat. I'm not afraid that they're going to cheat. I'm afraid they won't cheat. And that we'll live 15 years with Iran, not just under the NPT, but under, and in the safeguards agreement, but under the additional protocol, under expanded inspections and increased restrictions. And after 15 years of that, my God, they might be treated like a normal country in a normal time. They might be able to normalize their relationships with other countries in the region in other ways. And Israel just wants to keep the sanctions on forever, if not full-scale war and regime change. You know, talking about waiting around for Jeb, I guess. Or whoever comes next. So, but I think that, and you know, the BS isn't going to stop once they get the deal through. And by the way, Mitch McConnell, I hope he's not lying here. Maybe the fact he says this means it's not true. But apparently he has conceded that there is a great likelihood of success in terms of the votes in the Senate. So Pelosi, you know, already has said that she's got the votes by far in the House. They would need a 2/3 supermajority in both houses to override Obama's veto of what seems, you know, absolutely guaranteed that they will pass a disapproval of the deal. Obama will veto it, but they won't be able to override it, is how it's looking now, which is pretty much, you know, what I told you was going to happen months ago. It's too bad that Congress is willing to ally with a foreign power like this. But whatever, they'll do what they got to do. And by the way, you know what's funny? The guy in the chat room who asked me that question, which was a good question, I thought. And did I do a good job answering it? I think I did a good job answering it. Was I too flippant about it or something? Because I think he left. But he left a video. Check out the latest Iran video. And the latest Iran video, it's hilarious. I mean, whatever it is, I don't know the origin of the thing. But I guess it's supposed to be Iran Special Forces. And it looks just like the introduction to the Rambo cartoon that I used to watch when I was in fourth grade, where whenever S got real serious, all of a sudden he would retie his shoes and he would re-put his knife in his belt and he would retie his red headband on his head and all that. That's what happens in the thing. It's just like that. All the close-up shots of here he is putting an extra magazine in his vest, and then, but what's that in his hand? He's holding an American M16. Where'd he get those? From Richard Nixon? Or from Obama? Is that what it's supposed to mean? He's not here. He's not carrying an AK. He's carrying an American M16. And then it shows them all marching on Jerusalem. Well, here's what I got to say about that. Check the map. How in the hell are they supposed to get there? There's an entire Iraqi / Saudi / Jordanian desert and a river between Iran. And are they all going to be special forces guys equipped with the latest of American, I guess, M4s or whatever, you know, latest American equipment? And you know what? Maybe that was put out by Iran. It looked more like it was put out by the Crossroads Church down in San Antonio or something, right? But what do I know? I would not worry about it if I was an Israeli Jew, if that's what you're asking me. Are the Persian hordes about to march across all of Iraq and I guess, you know, northeastern or northwestern Saudi there and Jordan, swim across the Jordan River and invade the West Bank and Jerusalem, take Jerusalem? You know, I'm pretty sure that Israel can take them without any more American help. Although, you know, of all the accusations of Obama being anti-Israel, I always dismissed that. But then I read that Obama's giving them a bunch of F-35s, and I thought, that sneaky bastard. He's trying to sabotage the Israeli Air Force by saddling them with that piece of crap. Now, of course, we got to pay for it all, but they're going to have worthless jets replacing all their F-16s and F-15 Eagles. So I guess, you know, we'll see what happens there. I don't know. Maybe the Israelis can get them to work right. It doesn't seem likely, but, you know, I don't know. Sabotage, man. I'm telling you, it's sabotage. All right. I was missing something there. Oh, man, a bunch of things happened in the chat room I can't keep up with. Yeah, cover that. Oh, the cops, man. Let me talk about the cops in the last few minutes on the show here. Oh, no, wait. Let me say one more thing about the Iran thing. So we had the debate between Giraldi and Michael Pregent there. In case you're interested, here's what I've written about the EFP bombs. All of these are, the first one is from 06. The rest are from 07. And there's a story there. America switches sides in Iraq war. And by the way, these are all, I believe, on the antiwar.com blog, although I don't know why. I should have ran these all as original articles. America switches sides in Iraq war. March 16th, 2006. This was the first time Bush accused Iran of supplying the insurgency with IEDs. All right. I'll get back to that in a second. Then there's February 11th, 2007. Almost a year later. Iran supplying IEDs to Sunni insurgency? Huh. By me. Again, Iran supplying IEDs to Sunni insurgency. Next, Washington Post liars caught. And it was about they found EFP factory in Iraq, and then the Washington Post excised that portion of the AP story that they ran and replaced it, while other agencies did not edit that part out. And so it just left the Washington Post revisionism. And in fact, they replaced it with, which some say come from Iran. Instead of, yeah, they found, we see them with their own eyes, Operation Black Eagle. Here we are looking right at the EFPs. Christian Science Monitor had the real story. Reuters had the real story. Washington Post lied. Again, it's Washington Post liars caught. Again, by me, antiwar.com/blog. And then last and not least, I don't know, EFPs are made in Iraq by Iraqis. And I got, I don't know, 50 links in here. I don't know how many of them are still good, but all kinds of debunkings. And then, of course, I also mentioned Gareth Porter had this piece, U.S. Briefings on Iran Discredits Official Line, where even Peter Pace said, oh, well, it's clear Iranians are involved. Iranians, not the Iranians like the government, just Iranians are involved. And it's clear that materials from Iran are involved, he said, he continued. But I would not say, by what I know, that the Iranian government clearly knows or is complicit. That was Peter Pace, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff at the time, who had just been kicked upstairs from being the leader of that war. So, yeah, bitch, please. But now going back to the first one, America switches sides in Iraq war. So this was Bush's false start. The first accusation that Iran was supplying bombs to the Iraqi insurgency, it came and then it went. It was in March of 2006. And then that talking point disappeared. That story did not bubble up from Iraq. The president of the United States himself, George W. Bush, was the first one to debut it. And it was part of what Zalmay Khalilzad had come up with at the time, which it was also accredited to this guy, Nicholas Biddle's great-great nephew or something, I guess. I don't know. Stephen Biddle of Foreign Affairs wrote a piece called The Grand Illusion about switching sides back to the Sunnis and against the Shiites and balancing them again and this and that. But then the military nixed that, and they put it off. And then the so-called awakening and Petraeus's deal didn't come. Well, the deal didn't come until Petraeus came, and that was at the beginning of 2007. And then Petraeus was willing to make the deal with the Sunnis and go ahead and support them and build up the Sons of Iraq, the so-called Sons of Iraq, who were just Al-Qaeda guys a week before, and basically pay them to marginalize the jihadists. But anyway, so just more indications it was all part of a propaganda campaign rather than the reality. But just search my name, Scott Horton, and EFPs, and antiwar.com. You'll find four articles there. Thanks.